This episode is brought to you by Reese's Peanut Butter Cups. In breaking news, leading scientists worldwide are conducting experiments to determine if Reese's Peanut Butter Cups are the perfect combination of peanut butter and chocolate. However, it appears the study was inconclusive, as the scientists couldn't help but eat all the Reese's. Because when you want something sweet, you can't do better than Reese's. Find Reese's now at a store near you.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
Jonathan, hello and welcome once again to IGN's weekly PlayStation show. I'm your host, Max Scoville. This is episode 840, and joining me today is Brian Altano.
Hey,
what's up, man? How's it going?
How you doing, man? What's going on?
I'm doing okay. We were normally gonna have. I feel like last week we had somebody in the comments who was mad. I think we said like Helldivers is great or something in the headline. He was like, you know what else is great? Is consistent upload times. And you know, we all juggle a bunch of stuff. We all do a bunch of other projects, and sometimes monkey wrenches get thrown into the gears, and it totally screws up our whole process and our scheduling things. And like Jada and Akeem were supposed to be on this week, but they both had other obligations, and that didn't happen. And so now, very last minute, here's just the two of us. So
that's right. Let's get cozy. Little fireside chat, as they call it. GDC is happening right now. I think PAX is
GDC and PAX. They're like the sort of dueling banjos of like weird, you know, Q1 video game events or whatever. So that's
also just a surprisingly huge week for video games. We've got Rise of the Ronin, Dragon's Dogma, Princess Peach Showtime, Alone in the Dark. Yeah. We'll be talking about several of those today, not the Peach one. You can go check out Nintendo Voice Chat for talk about that one.
We can talk about that. No, I do want to talk about Dragon's Dogma a little bit. I've been playing a bunch of that. I played a little bit of Rise of the Ronin. I think we'll probably try to do a deeper dive on that next week. The reviews are both going up at various points this week, and the games themselves are, I guess, out tail end of this week. But the big thing we should probably talk about is the PlayStation 5 Pro specs that leaked, which is a thing we've heard lots of murmuring and muttering about, and this just sort of trickled out. And this is, you know, you get like, I feel like when specs leak, it's like, what does that mean? It's just like a list of information. It's not quite as, you know, damning as like, here's a photo of somebody holding a console up, or like, here's gameplay footage of a thing with watermarks all over it. Like, this is a little bit, you know, kind of harder to parse, but our, you know, news team did their due diligence and, you know, sniffed around, and apparently this is sort of, this seems legit. The headline improvements to the PlayStation 5 Pro, and again, you know, just take this with a grain of salt because it could be slightly off or completely inaccurate, but we're rolling with it. Headline improvements here are to the CPU, which is said to be identical to the standard PS5 CPU, but with a high CPU frequency mode, which amounts to a 10% increase to 3.85 gigahertz, and the GPU, which enables faster rendering and higher quality ray tracing powered by 33.5 teraflops. The standard PS5 offers 10.28 teraflops. However, a direct PS5 to PS5 Pro comparison would work out at around 10.28 versus 16 to 17 teraflops. So, did you get it? Did you get all that?
Yeah. No, totally locked in. This is great. I think it's gonna be. No, I actually, I don't know enough about specs and hardware to see this and hear this and get excited for it. But I do know that this is the best way to play GTA 6 when that game comes out, then that's what, then I'll get it. You know what I'm saying?
Like, yeah,
it's because I'm stupid, right? Because I did the same thing. I believe it was the Xbox One X was deemed at the time to be the best place to play Red Dead. And I think I bought it on PS5, and then I traded in the Xbox X. What did we call those things back? The Xbox One. Yeah.
One.
And then I hate what they do over there. Sometimes I love their consoles. I hate their naming conventions. Just put a number on it, please. And so, yeah, so I traded that in and got that. And with the PS4, I traded mine in and got the PS4 Pro. So if this is like one of those things that makes sense, that it's going to be the best place to play GTA 6, then that's what I'll do. But like, I'm going to be a little bitter if there isn't a ton of other games taking advantage of it. Also, like, I don't know, man. I'm a little worried about the price tag for something like this. Like this feels like you're heading into $600, $700 territory, which, you know, realistically isn't that insane for a next gen console, considering if you priced out a PC, it'd be $1,000 or more.
No, that's exactly it. Is like the obvious comparison here is that like mid-century modern upgrade, mid-gen, you know, refreshes, it starts to feel like phones or PCs, and it's like, that's not exciting, you know, like there's no like sizzle or pageantry. It's just things getting incrementally more powerful, and like maybe you feel compelled to buy it. If you slept on it the first time around, this seems like the smart place to jump on. But yeah,
I'm trying to picture a mid-century PlayStation. And it's a just like
I would be way more into a mid-century modern PS5 than
it's,
whatever.
It's it is like a wooden bicycle with a guy on it holding up different pictures, doing a puppet
just,
show.
You know, just groovy Jetsons coffee table looking thing.
Yeah,
but no, I mean, at the end of the day, as expensive as this might get, it's still cheaper than PC gaming. Which is, you know, not a jab at PC gaming. PC gaming is awesome. You pay more and you get more versatility. You are ahead of the curve. But again, to your point, are developers able to take advantage of it? Like, we are at a point where we're still getting PS4 games.
Yeah.
And, you know, I feel like it's like if you buy a Lamborghini, you still get stuck in traffic, you know?
Yeah.
You still have to stop at stoplights, and you still have to obey the speed limit, assuming you're not on the Autobahn or whatever. But like, developers are obviously, they're going to cater to what has the biggest install base. They're going to make games that run in as many places as possible. They're going to try to optimize it. You know, occasionally you see developers that come out just really swinging for the fences. Like the big obvious one would be the first Crysis, where they were like, we have made this game that is going to look amazing still in like 12 years. And then take a look at, you know, the early reveals of like Cyberpunk 2077, which arguably may be a little bit misleading, but fast forward a couple of years and it's like, oh no, this is, they delivered on that front. Like, you could do some insane stuff with ray tracing in there. There's, if you have like a really high-end rig, it makes that game look amazing. And that is a game that sort of, it allows you to really just open it up and just kind of go nuts and see what it's capable of. And I'm sure when this PS5 Pro comes out, whatever the specs are, there will be a bunch of games that get little patches that like push those games further. You know, it's some little bells and whistles that take advantage of the new features that, you know, as a result, like, you know, we didn't get a PS5 version of The Last of Us Part 2 or of God of War officially early on, but there were like, there were little, you know, there were patches that were like, this has a PS5, you know, mode.
Yes.
It takes advantage of the hardware, which is cool. And now we're going to get PS5 Pro versions of that, I suppose. That's what we're getting here.
I think that's awesome. And that's, I will say that that's like the bare minimum that I expect, but I do think it's, and I mentioned this a couple weeks ago, but I think it's odd that like there is a push for this console when we really don't know a lot about any official first party Sony games in development right now. Like if this comes out and they're like, hey, you can play The Last of Us Part 2 again with better hair, and they're like, hey, you can see that JPEG of New Jersey in the background of Spider-Man 2. It's a little more clear now, you know, you can see Brian's old house. Or they're like, hey, you know, there's, you know, bells and whistles and God of War Ragnarok and Horizon. Like, awesome, cool. Bare minimum, that's what I expect. But I've played all those games already. I beat all those games. I love all those games. But like, now what? You know, like, what is the next big PlayStation first party games that are coming that are going to take advantage of something like this? Because that's what I want. That, like, and I know third parties will be there. Like, obviously, that's going to do a lot of heavy lifting for a product like this. But I want this thing to also like kind of go hand in hand with like a new, like a big new game launch would be awesome to go with this, to be like, hey, you want this new console? It, you know, this is the best place to play this game right here. Cause like, if the rumor is that this could theoretically be out by the end of the year, right?
I think so. Yeah.
Yeah. And so like that misses GTA 6, which is not this year. They don't really currently have any big games that we're expecting this fall, right?
It's a weird generation. Like it is, yeah. it is a weird console generation. We still have, you know, we still have cross generation games. We still are getting PS4 games. It's, which is wild to think about, because that is now what, an 11-year-old console.
Yeah,
that's old. That's hardware from a cool minute ago, and to try to, you know, accommodate that is wild. And to, you know, to put out a new piece of hardware and be like, oh, this is, you know, this is really gonna, this feels like getting in front of PlayStation 6, you know, the idea that people are maybe going to jump on this version, assuming that maybe enough people will adopt this, that even if they don't jump on the PS6 when it comes out, that there'll be some, you know, there's like, who even, you know, playing PS4 stuff right now, I would be really curious who's playing on a base PS4 still. And I'm sure there are definitely people out there, obviously.
Yeah.
But yeah. as for people who bought the base PS4 when it came out, who are still using it, like we saw what, you know, what Cyberpunk looked like when it was running on the base PS4, and it was rough. Like it's
rough.
It's rough. Like you get the feeling that it's, you know, it's, again, it's sort of a mid-gen bump under the assumption that, you know, maybe you didn't buy it the first time around. But the thing about, you know, a pro upgrade, or, you know, this sort of this type of thing, it usually comes with a price cut. And everything we've heard indicates that Sony's not going to have a price cut on the base PS5, which makes this whole thing seem sort of stupid. And
yeah, you're 100% right. Like, I feel like when something like this comes out, then you need to slash $50-$100 off of the base model. And then you get a bunch of people who are like, all right, I'm in now. Finally, I'm in. And then you'll get people like me who trade in their base model and get the PS5 Pro. And then like, I don't know if you'll get anybody who, or how many people you'll get who are like, I haven't bought a PS5 yet, but now that they have a pro model, I'm going to get into this console generation. You know, I'm finally making the left turn onto the highway, and I'm going to play next gen console games. Like, I don't know if there was anybody specifically, or maybe a very, very small group of people were looking at the specs of the base PS5 at launch, and they were looking at games like Spider-Man and, you know, God of War Ragnarok and stuff like that, which, you know, like the Ragnarok is cross-gen, the new Spider-Man isn't. And so I wonder how many of those people actually exist who are like, I'm not buying a PS5 until a more powerful one comes out. Or maybe they're waiting, because, like, you know, Sony and Xbox have both conditioned people to think that mid-gen console refreshes with better power and processing are coming. And so maybe there were people who were like, you know, it's been, you know, 4 years this fall will be since the PS4 came out, which is insane to think that we're already, you know, 4 years into this generation. But I do wonder how many people were like looking at this being like, not yet. Huh. Okay, perfect. Yeah. I was waiting for the $700 one that was, you know, slightly better. Like, I don't know. It's sort of a baffling product to me. I think it's like in something like the PS4 era, where it just felt sort of anecdotally like there were more games, there was more first party games in general. I think it made more sense, but like right now, I don't know if you're going to get a lot of like general audience enthusiasm out of a product like this, outside of like the people who have PS5s or in the ecosystem, they want something better to play. GTA 6, right? Like, that's the only way to really do it. If you have to glue this thing to a game like GTA, and you have to say, hey, are you excited for the most anticipated game in video game history? Well, this is the best place to play it that doesn't involve spending $1,000 on a PC, right? And you get to, you know, you get to play with your buddies on PlayStation or whatever. Like, that's the only way to really get that message across. I do think it's interesting that these specs leaked, because the same exact thing happened with Xbox. Their alleged rumored mid-gen console refresh also leaked, that kind of like circular thing that said it was like adorably all digital or whatever.
Yeah, that was a little different. That they accidentally like put up public, you know, court documents on,
yes,
in the Freedom of Information Act or whatever it was. Like that was folder, that wasn't, yeah, that wasn't your conventional leak. That was the midst of a, you know, giant federal trial that they were like, this is public information. Oops, no, it's not.
That's true.
Elder Scrolls 6 release date. no, this is, again, I take it all with a grain of salt. It's fun to speculate about, unless it isn't, unless it's kind of boring to speculate about it. Like, we're at a point where the games are, you know, developers are struggling to keep up with the hardware. You know, it's less like that we're seeing, I mean, I don't know. I don't make games. I don't see people stressing about the limitations of the PS5. You know, I'm not going to point any fingers, but the real culprit here is the Series S. Like, like if any, and you know, last gen, obviously, like the
and things the Switch, that are, you yeah, know, the like Switch. When you see like Mortal Kombat running on Switch, and then you see it running on the next gen consoles, and you're like, oh, you forgot to finish Johnny Cage's face.
Yeah, you know, well, like, that's that, you know, that's always been the yeah, you know, kind of the case. But yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Destin Legarry said something the other day about how it's everything's being done so much with like engines. Like it's more about software doing heavy lifting and more about things being done to facilitate, you know, to make sure the hardware can process the stuff that's being thrown at it. It's I mean, again, we don't make games. We speculate. We talk to each other while wearing matching t-shirts, apparently. But like it's weird to think about that stuff. Like it the point of a console obviously is to have like a versatile machine that can chew up and spit out whatever's thrown at it, but there still is a certain amount of work that has to be done on the developer's part to make sure the games function and optimize them and all that. And you know, it gets tricky the more different versions of a piece of hardware they have to jump through. Like this was the weird wrinkle with Cyberpunk when it launched. They were like, I know it seems like we're launching on two platforms, but actually we're launching on you know, it's like the base PS4, the PS4 Pro, and then we also have to make it work on the PS5, and then also all those corresponding versions of PC. Xbox, and then every PC, and then Stadia. And it's like you know it gets tricky there, because suddenly you know, coming to one platform, if it's, you know, PS5, that used to be one platform, that used to be one machine, and now it's one with a little
one and a half
asterisk or whatever. There's another detail here that I think is a sort of a two-parter. One part is really cool, and one part is deeply disappointing. Of particular interest, the PS5 Pro is said to have an upscaling/anti-aliasing solution called PSSR, which is Professional Sustained Silent Reading. No, it's PlayStation Spectral Super Resolution Upscaling, which sounds hella cool. I like when they use the word super to describe things. Yeah. It makes me excited because I'm a 90s kid. custom machine learning architecture and an AI accelerator. I don't know what most of that means, but it sounds high tech and exciting. That's fun.
Yeah.
Elsewhere, PS5 Pro has a detachable disk drive and 1 terabyte of storage space, which is, I believe, a 125 gig upgrade compared to the PS5 base model, which had
800 and then used like 150 for the OS.
Which was a step backwards from the PS4 Pro, which is, and again, it's a cool, you know, lightning fast proprietary hard drive. And if you have the means, you can pop that bad boy open and put in a new SSD that has a heat sink, assuming you do all that extra research and figure out how to do that and really just want to go to that trouble. I just think maybe just put in a bigger hard drive. Maybe just, you know, if you're going to charge extra, just throw it in there.
It makes me feel crazy, because like if you know, you mentioned being a 90s kid, like when we were little, I'm like the idea of like a, you know, expandable additional storage media or whatever, like SD cards and stuff like that, and like hard drives. We were joking about how like I don't even think we had like 100 gig hard drives back then. Like the first one I saw that was, and it was like loud, it had actual mechanical parts in it and stuff like that. But like seeing SD cards over the years get tinier and larger in file size and cheaper. Like I remember when I bought a terabyte micro SD card for Switch for like 100-something bucks, and this is 6-7 years ago now, right? And it like blew my mind that that's how far we'd come. And at the exact same time, the console guys, and Xbox does this too, Xbox is worse with it actually, because they use proprietary bullshit, so you have to get these like funny little things to stick in the back, and they're like rarely on sale. PlayStation at least is like, hey, you can, you know, you have options here. Over in console land, they still pretend like this is the most rarest resource in the entire world. And it's like, dude, just make it bigger. Just make it 2 terabytes. Like that, how that can't possibly be hurting you that much. Like how much money could 2 terabytes be?
Well, it's got a little T1000 in it. It's got liquid mercury metal inside there that makes Spider-Man look even shinier and run faster or whatever. Like,
great. Great, yeah. Figure it out.
I feel like the PS5 hard drive is from the same design school as the memory stick duo, where it's like, what makes this so special? It's special, and I'm sure it is. It's probably very complicated, but again, yeah, I don't know.
I mean, like games like, you know, Mortal Kombat, Call of Duty is now like a 150 gigabyte game with all the stuff in it. GTA 6 is absolutely going to be massive. Like, I don't even know if we should do that thing, you know, like where you guess the jelly bean jar or whatever. We should do that with GTA 6's file
size.
That's
a good idea. Just get a
like, honestly.
Yeah.
Yeah. We should get like an office contest going. We'll put up a picture of it. And then underneath be like, how many gigs do you think this is? But either way, like that's, you know, 850 after the OS eats
after,
up
after memory taxes or whatever.
After memory taxes, is like seven games now. Like that, you know, or like you get a bunch of tiny little indie games, but it's like,
no, that's I love how the PlayStation 5 hard drive has become like the Resident Evil 4 briefcase where you're just constantly shuffling stuff around and getting rid of things. You're like, I guess I'm gonna eat this chicken egg because I can't carry it around with me. No, it's
me with all my big bass.
this is a stupid complaint because again, we don't know what this machine can do. This is a bunch of, this is specs. You don't like, there will be specs in the marketing and promotions for this machine when it comes out, but there's an entire department dedicated to making this stuff digestible and presumably also selling it, making it look sexy, making it look cool, hyping it up, making it look exciting. So right now it's kind of like, I don't know, there's a new flavor of Dorito coming out, here are the nutrition facts. Like, that's not, you know, that's not gonna get you all amped up to be flavor blasted or whatever.
And again, like, we're fully aware that it's very easy to add a, you know, expandable storage to your PS5. I just think that like that shouldn't necessarily be a step that every PS5 owner has to do.
The whole point of consoles is that they're for little babies.
Yeah,
adult babies, even people who don't want to get out screwdrivers and have to, you know, deal with that stuff. I'm just saying,
the big grown pants poopers who cry.
Yeah, I don't know. The whole point of big a console babies. is simplicity and convenience. That's it. It's a fun machine that you don't have to worry about that stuff with. You shouldn't have to pop it open and worry about, you know, frying a hard drive or, you know, spilling all of your snack food inside the hard drive, which could happen. I don't want to go in there. Anyway, the first cell phone was demonstrated in 1973 by Martin Cooper. You know what wasn't demonstrated? Shared plans. Over 50 years later, you can save on one line thanks to Visible. When you switch to Visible, the wireless company that makes wireless visible, you can get a one-line plan with unlimited 5G data powered by Verizon for just $25 a month, taxes and fees included. No hidden fees. No, really. You can look around for them. They're not there. Switch now at Visible.com. Save on wireless without the hassle. Switch to Visible today and save at Visible.com. Monthly rate on the Visible plan. For data management practices and additional terms, visit Visible.com. This episode of Podcast Beyond is brought to you by NordVPN, a great way to protect yourself online while also improving your overall experience while enjoying cyberspace. Are you tired of streaming shows, movies, or sporting events being unavailable in your region due to draconian restrictions that are based on completely arbitrary geographical boundaries in physical meat space? Well, switch your virtual location to a place where that's no longer an issue. The same goes for shopping. You can get the best possible deal on subscriptions, flights, hotels, and other goods and services like that from websites that like to play favorites with certain territories and currencies. Meanwhile, encrypted traffic protects your data from hackers, viruses, malware, phishing sites, and other harmful hitchhikers of the information superhighway. Though really, it's more of an information autobahn because there is no speed limit with NordVPN. It is the fastest VPN in the world, so there won't be any buffering or lagging, and it'll stop your ISP from throttling your bandwidth. Isn't that nice? One NordVPN account can be used across 6 devices, which is great. My wife has been using our account to watch all sorts of awful British reality TV shows that aren't available here, like Argument Island or Half Naked Idiots Fall in Love, and everyone's favorite, The Worst People Just Got Married. Let's hear them talk about it. Shows that are so bad they're blocked in our part of the world for our own good, but luckily, NordVPN allows her to trick the internet into thinking she's in the UK so she and her awful friends can shriek and howl and cackle at the TV while I'm trying to relax. I've been using my VPN too. You know what I've been using it for? None of your business. Yep, that's right. And thanks to NordVPN, my data is safely encrypted, all bundled up in a weighted security blanket of incomprehensibly complex math problems, and nobody can tell what it's doing under there. Data, you do your thing. I'll leave you alone. 1 month of NordVPN coverage costs less than a cup of coffee. Coffee can't protect you from cyber criminals unless you throw it at them or pour it on their computers, and you'll probably get in trouble for doing that. So get NordVPN instead. To get the best possible discount off your NordVPN plan, go to nordvpn.com/pobeyond. That link will also give you 4 extra months on the 2-year plan. There's no risk with Nord's 30-day money-back guarantee. Again, that is nordvpn.com/pobeyond. And now, back to the show. Let's talk about some games. There's some cool games that came out. Dragon's Dogma 2 is out soon, tomorrow, something. The review is up, I think. I believe IGN gave it an 8 out of 10, saying it's great. Our reviewer, in the sort of opening paragraph, calls out something that is such a wonderful spot on description of not just what I think Dragon's Dogma 2 does, but I feel like what makes a good video game sequel, which is he compares it to Evil Dead 2, in that it's kind of a remake, but it is like it takes a lot of the same beats, but just improves them. It's taking stuff that is sort of that worked the first time around and just making it cooler and bigger without trying to totally outdo itself. You know, like we see these sequels where they're like big, huge, massive departures. Like occasionally we see, oh, I don't know, a game that adds an entire dimension, or it goes from like, oh, this is linear, now it's open world. This takes a lot of what was working in the original Dragon's Dogma and just kind of iterates on it. And, you know, it's obviously like it's a much prettier looking game. I think it's been, 13 years since the first one came out.
Yeah. Wow.
And that first game was a really cool game. Like that game was really ahead of its time. And I think at a glance, you're like, what is this? Is this like open world Dark Souls? What's the deal? What's going on? And for anybody who didn't mess with the first one, it's got quirks. It's like a very quirky game.
Quirks is a good
game.
Way to describe it. Yeah.
Yeah, you played a little bit, Brian. Did you?
I did. And you're 100% right. And the thing is, it's like quirks is a good word to describe something that could be like a charm or a grievance, right? Like it's like, and I think that like the first game has sort of manifested such a strong fan base and kind of cult of personality around it that people were willing to kind of brush aside some of the, you know, less than I'm not even sure what the word to use is here, because there's a bunch of stuff that modern games have figured out how to do that Dragon's Dogma doesn't do, nor is it particularly interested in doing them. And I don't necessarily think it's like a deal breaker for anything, but it's just kind of obtuse by design. And that's part of its charm, right? And like this is coming from two people who are obsessed with games like Bloodborne and Dark Souls and Elden Ring, and these are games that are like, you know, full of needless complications and stupidry and all sorts of stuff that's just kind of like, you know, like how do you get the best ending in Bloodborne, right? Like you have to eat.
We don't even talk about it. It's pretty gross.
Yeah. Okay. It's like, and you would never know it. Like even accessing the DLC in FromSoft games is confusing. It's going to be confusing when they do it in Elden Ring. And I love those games for that. And so it's like, I don't want to dock points on this one for being like a little weird around the edges, for having a lot of different things in it that it doesn't necessarily tell you. It's the kind of thing where it's like, I don't know, the IGN guides team assembles and they put together these incredible things that like
this is the kind of game that's going to kill one of them. It's just
100%. But it's like, you know, how to change the time of day, you know, how to go to sleep, like little things like that it's just like I think that finding out some of it on your own is really fun. Like when I found my first like camping set and was like, oh, you can pitch a tent over here, and there you can kind of talk to your buddies and you can cook. And then once you start cooking, there's like these incredible actual food films.
Oh my God. Right. Like, I love how just, like people are like, what's the new game? Like, is it cool? Can you fight dragons? And we're like, let's talk about the pork chops. Yeah. I almost texted you when I got there, cause I feel like there's a lot in this game that's really gorgeous. There's parts where it kind of like, it almost looks like they sort of up-res the old one. Like there's parts where it just it doesn't look super impressive, but I mean that's the same. I feel like I have the same gripe about like FromSoft games. But the food in this game is some of the most stunning looking food I've ever seen, to the point that I was like, yeah, I mean, you know, you're at the camp, you're like, oh, I'm gonna cook this little, you know, this scrap of scraggy beast or whatever. And then it just shows you this incredible, gorgeous, like greasy piece of meat just frying up, and I was like, oh my Lord, that is pretty.
I was like drooling looking at it. I think it's literally a video of a steak cooking.
I can't tell, dude. I mean it's running in the RE engine, which is, there's plenty of stuff in Resident Evil when you look at it up close, you're like, this is, you know, stunningly realistic. This can render things very beautifully. And but no, on the broader scale of things, the obtuseness is absolutely worth talking about. In an alternate timeline, Dragon's Dogma was Dark Souls. I mean, I think Dark Souls is already out when Dragon's Dogma came out or whatever, but this is the one that you know, spun off and became this whole genre and this whole thing, and it inspired. And I think anybody coming at this expecting, you know, expecting it to play like Elden Ring or expecting it to play like Dark Souls is in for maybe not a disappointment, but a surprise, because it is an entirely different experience, an entirely different gameplay loop. But the underlying thing is that it has that same faith that you'll figure out how to play it. And it has that same faith that you will probably run to your friends and be like, have you gotten this thing? Did you find this thing? And maybe your friends didn't find that thing because that thing was buried in a weird cave and you went in that weird cave yourself and they went into a different weird cave. And I love that about it. I love that so much.
Our reviewer was talking about having like played through the game in its entirety and then like kind of re-rolling on a second playthrough and then texting people who were also in the same situation. And like they had all seen different things. Mm-hmm. Like there were things that like he hadn't seen that they had and vice versa. That's what's fascinating to me. That's that magic we got from Elden Ring, right? Where you're like, and Tears of the Kingdom and other great open world games where you're like, where do I go? Like, where should I go? Mm-hmm. Like you have quest markers and you have things that, you know, there's NPCs telling you to do stuff and, you know, but you can just go off and get in trouble too, which is really fun. And just turn a corner and be like, am I supposed to be here yet? I think that like one of the things, and like, I'm digging this game. I need to be abundantly clear here. But like, if I wasn't, I would have bailed because there's no lock on. And like, I know that's like one of those, like, I'm going to look directly to the camera here. I'm fully aware that I'm a big fan of a bunch of needlessly obtuse FromSoft games that do all this idiotic nonsense that they make you figure it out by yourself, and they still have lock on in them. I think that's one of those things that games should have. This is not me asking for an easy mode. This is not me asking for, you know, baby zone everywhere you go. And like, I love hard games. I love weird games. I love games that don't make a lot of sense that you have to figure out yourself. They're great. I love like reading lore and guides and all that fun stuff. This game needs a lock on. Like, I
kind of get it, but I feel like it's one of those things where you kind of just squint at it. You're like, is this the idea? Is this the point? The combat is it's very different from something like a FromSoft game. It feels much more fun. Is that the right word? Like it lets you, I don't know. It feels more playful, and there's a bunch of different, you know, skill sets and classes and jobs and stuff to figure out. But I feel like when you get a sort of, you have much more gimmicky special moves. Whereas in, I don't know, like I'm playing as a thief, and one of the things I got that's awesome is I can put little sticks of dynamite in the ground, and then I can lure people into them and blow them up. I can also, I think, put the dynamite on people and then like flip off of them and then blow them off. And I not you know blow them up, not blow them off. I don't know, just like cancel plans. And then I have like a scorpion's harpoon, like I have a grappling hook that I can just throw at people and pull them towards me. So I can, you know, put that little dynamite in the ground and pull them towards it and just blow it up. And it's just, it's a level of sort of video gaminess that you don't see that in FromSoft. There is, you know, there are elements like that, but I feel like more often than not, it's that comes down to almost the sort of moment to moment. There's a kind of inherent chaos to Dragon's Dogma that is, that's it. It's the chaos, because there is, mm-hmm. you've got pawns running around. We'll get to them in a second. The pawns are these sort of like NPC companions. They sometimes do the right thing, and a lot of the time they do not do the right thing. And
oh my God.
I don't even blame them, because it's interesting and it's funny. And then you get sort of, you know, you get that emergent, you get the emergent hilarity that happens. Like the kind of thing that reminds me of like Far Cry, where, you know, you're fighting bandits or whatever, you know, bad guys, whatever they are. And then a tiger shows up, and then they're fighting the tiger, and you're fighting the tiger, and everyone's fighting each other. That happens in this with monsters, and it's great.
Going to bring that up. Like you're spot on. Like I was thinking about how this sort of takes like the kind of the DNA of like a quintessential party-based 16-bit RPG, and then it throws in like the chaotic element of an open world game like Far Cry. Like literally with the fire, where your character is running away from it, and your NPCs, your pawns or whatever, are just like, I'm gonna stand in it. And you're like, don't stand in the fire, Chris. Don't do it. Like it's so funny.
No, I think that is specifically it. Is that everything in FromSoft games is incredibly carefully placed, and it's all very deliberate, and it's all about, you know, everyone's like, oh, it's super easy. You just need to learn the boss patterns. You just need to recognize the patterns and then do them. In this case, that maybe isn't so much a thing you can do. because maybe you recognize the patterns, but maybe your pawns are putting sticks of dynamite in the ground or jumping off cliffs or throwing pigs at each other. Like, there's all kinds of silly stuff that can happen in this game. And I like that. I like that level of chaos. I also like that there it leans heavily on physics. And if you lean heavily on physics, physics might knock over. There is like, there's just, you know, there's destructible things in this game. You know, in a FromSoft game, I feel like if you, you know, if you lure a boss out onto a bridge and he falls off the bridge, that counts as cheesing the boss. In this, that counts. It's fair game. It's totally allowed. That's the kind of thing you can do. You know, if you want to open up, like break a dam and just flood water somewhere to knock over a monster and then kick him, you know, punch him in the face or whatever, you know, get him when he's on the ground and just everyone climbs on top of him. And there's like, Jarrett digs into this in the review, and it didn't even occur to me, but depending on how you build your character, there's different aspects here. Like if you are a taller character with longer arms, you can grab, you can pick things up, grab things more easily, but it also takes you longer to recover if you get knocked down because you're taller. I get that. I'm a tall guy. It hurts in the morning sometimes. And it's little things like that. I don't even think about that, but it's, yeah, I there's something just very tactile about it. You know, and
yeah,
there's room in games for both these things to exist. And I really, the sort of the patience you have to learn with this sort of game is to laugh it off and to just kind of recognize that, you know, all best, you know, best laid plans of men and pawns or whatever are, you know, bound to go awry. This is, yeah, things can just go completely sideways here in a way that's very different from the sort of the FromSoft you died. Like,
yes.
I remember reading some interview with Miyazaki talking about how the deaths in you know, in Souls games are kind of jokes. Like, they're sort of punchlines. You know, the idea is that you didn't expect that to happen. And there's a little bit, when you kind of stop and think about it, it is often very Looney Tunes. Like a cartoon boulder just comes and gets you, or you know, a
hammer or something. Yeah.
A skeleton falls out of the ceiling and just punches you in the face so hard that you explode. Or maybe you look at the moon too hard and blood shoots out of your ears because you went insane. Whatever it is, there's always some, and there's a level of like kind of comedy to it where you just go, oh, I didn't see that one coming and that's why I'm dead. But there's also an expectation that you learn from that. And in this case, there's obviously, you know, there's a learning curve. There's stuff you learn how to do, but there's also the sort of expectation that you cannot, you didn't anticipate it. You can't predict it. It's less about timing, more about, you know, improvisation and rolling with the punches. And I'm very into that. And it's, as far as sort of open worlds go, this feels much more, how do I put this? Elden Ring was sort of the typical kind of FromSoft thing where everything is in its right place. You know where everything is. It's all, there's nothing random. Everything is very curated, very manicured, very deliberate, and it's, you know, precision. And in this case, there's more of a feeling of you don't know what's out there. You know, there's obviously when you know, the first time exploring any video game, there's levels of surprises here. But in this case, there's very much a feeling of like, don't go out at night. Don't go out at night because you're going to get, you're going to get so killed. And they do a thing, we talked about this earlier, the director was talking about how there's not really fast travel in a conventional sense. There's you have to get these like fairy stones, which are really expensive early on, and you have to, you know, it's complicated fast travel, which the point of that is to make you play the game and go explore it and get lost in the world. You can also take an ox cart, which again is like, I love how obtuse it is. In the moment when I'm trying to get somewhere, maybe I don't love it, but I appreciate the idea behind it, which is you basically have to catch the bus. And if you miss the bus, you got to wait for the next bus.
Yeah, maybe, it's wild.
If the bus breaks down because of monsters, you are screwed. You're out in the middle of nowhere. Like, and it's just, there's something really that it forces you to engage with the world in a very different, very kind of grounded way. Like, it's almost kind of a survival thing as opposed to being like, I'm going to be the best. I don't know. It's, we're going around in circles here, but I really,
no. It's like, again, like if you're listening to this and these are quirks, if you think that these are charming, then you're going to love this stuff. If you think that these are grievances or annoyances, then the game does push back with a lot of like sort of features that we may have come to understand as like modern and standardized across the board for most games, right? But I don't know. This is a series that has like a massive community following behind it. It's got like, millions of people deeply love this franchise. And I think that, like, you know, if you've never played these games before, and this sounds interesting to you, you can learn to deal with the quirks, and you'll find an experience that's like really, really cool and really interesting.
That's the big thing, is that it's surprising, and it's something, it's something fresh. Like, the last time we got something that felt like this, it was Dragon's Dogma. And so many games, they introduce some killer mechanic and we're like, wow, this is amazing. And then it shows up everywhere else and it becomes just sort of, you know, just kind of muscle memory. It becomes run of the mill, and that takes some of the magic out of this. The pawn system is not something I've seen anywhere else that I can recall. And basically what you do there is you make an NPC, you make your own little sort of companion, and then they can go into other people's games. And it's sort of this asymmetrical thing where basically they stay in your game. Like, it's not like you lose them because they're off doing other stuff, but their stats and their characteristics and all the stuff that they picked up traveling with you is then applied to me knocking stuff over in the background. it's then applied to another person's game, which is, I really dig that. Like, it's funny because it's unclear exactly how much of it is, like, it reminds me of the Nemesis system in a way from Shadow of Mordor, where there's a lot of it is just kind of like, it's behind the scenes, it's boxes checked,
it's working in the background,
and
math
and stats and stuff, but the level of sort of facade put on it makes it really easy to sort of imagine what's happening. And there's, God, a really funny thing happened. Jada, I was sending pictures to this, we have like a Dragon's Dogma thread, and I have pictures of my player character, who is just straight up, it's just Glenn Danzig from the Misfits and other bands, and he is just picking up a hog that is bigger than he is and just hoisting it off a bridge, just throwing it as hard as he could. And I messed around in the photo mode and got some very, you know, very flattering shots of him just chucking this hog. And I sent that, everyone laughed about it. And then a couple hours later, Jada was like, hey, I hired your pawn, Robin, you know, like the Swedish pop star. And she's been throwing people off bridges. And I was just like, I don't know where she learned it. Was
Did
that
she
from
learn
me?
That from watching you?
I don't know. I straight up don't know if that's one of those things. Is the game picking that up? Or is that just a coincidence? Is that just a thing certain pawns will do? It's hard to say. But, you know, that said, like, if there was a, you know, if there was a treasure or a ladder or something that I encountered on my trip, maybe, you know, Robin, when she's off in somebody else's game, is like, arisen, behold, a ladder, horse forsooth, and hark. You know, like, they do this thing where they borrow pieces of information from places they go. The other thing I love, and this feels like when you give villagers trash in Animal Crossing, except it's a little bit more mean than that. Whatever pawn that I had working for me, I had to send them home, and I just gave them rotten fish in their pockets. And so whoever's pawn that was, they pop up back in their game, and they're like, Master, I bring good tidings from another realm. And it's just like rotten fish. It's like when you're, you know, when your pet brings you dead rodents.
No, that's very specifically like when I would send like mean letters to villagers and be like, hey, Aziz, your house sucks. Get out. You know?
Yeah.
And then he would show it to like he would go to my girlfriend's town at the time and just be like, hey, look at this letter Brian gave me. And she'd call me and be like, what's wrong with you?
I love it.
That's great. I do want to shout out, there's, and I forget if the first game had this, but you can give all your pawns nicknames and yourself nicknames. And a lot of them are Capcom Easter eggs. Like, one of them is straight up Mega Man, which is great. There's Leon from Resident Evil. Like, there's a whole bunch of like different names and phrases and sort of nicknames and stuff like that, game titles and stuff that are synonymous with like Capcom fandom. And I've always really liked their ability to do that. Like, they're really great at cross-referencing themselves as companies or as a company. Like, even I remember like back to Dead Rising getting like the, you know, the Mega Man Buster thing with the little, you get the little, you know, the arm cannon and they start firing it off. I love all that stuff. They're so good about that, and it makes an appearance here, and it's again like it's little things like that add like a ton of like kind of flavor and personality to this game. So yeah, I'm really excited to see how this thing lives out in the wild with millions of people playing it.
Big, deep game. And it's also the kind of game that you can't really, like, even if you mainline it, even if you speedrun it, there's still a bunch of stuff that you left on the table or whatever. And I'm so excited to sort of kind of see the stuff that trickles out of it. I feel like all the sort of the hype built up by people who played the original has sunk in a little bit. So there's sort of a word of mouth affecting this, but I hope people get into it, and I hope it we get some I don't know. I'm happy to have it. It's satisfying on the sort of the big the big open world sprawl that I need to get lost in front, you know, like there's a special kind of like high I'm always chasing of like, I want to go in like a castle and I want to see what's in there. And if there's something good in there, then I feel good. But it doesn't work with every castle. Sometimes the castles disappoint me. Sometimes I don't like being in that world. This one, it works. It's clicking. It's a good time.
Yep.
I get to throw hogs off the bridge. I'm into that. Ryan, you played a bunch of Alone in the Dark. What's going on over there?
I did. Okay. So these are those tough games to talk about because, so I believe IGN gave it a 6 out of 10. Tristan in the UK did the review. I read it this morning and it's spot on. I completely agree with him. Alone in the Dark is a remake of the original Alone in the Dark, which is one of the first survival horror games ever, or one of the first like 3D survival horror games ever, inspired so many games after it. And this is sort of like a completely from the ground up reimagining of that, in the same way that like Resident Evil 2 remake it was a remake of the original sort of like top down fixed locked camera angle thing and turns it into a third person, you know, action shooter game. Not as successful as Capcom's fares in this genre. But I still really like it. Like, I think there's like enough in here that like kept me totally compelled. I think the setting is really cool. Like this sort of like creepy house setting is like really, really well built. I really liked going from room to room and solving like strange obtuse puzzles and getting specific items and keys to open doors. Like it had that sort of like classic Resident Evil 1 feel to me, with some sort of more outdoor areas and like with the Resident Evil 2 controls. I think where it falters a little bit is that the combat is fine, but I never really particularly felt like I was going to get killed or I felt scared or anything like that. Like it's weird because like I think like the enemy design is interesting and they get a decent amount of mileage out of like a couple of specific designs that they sort of flip in different directions, but it doesn't like the gunplay and traversal don't really feel like specifically amazing or anything like that. They're just all pretty good, and when you combine a bunch of like good, okay, and pretty good stuff, you get a game that's like a 6 or a 7 out of 10, and that's totally fine. But like I think I was expecting a little bit more here. I think the performances from the leads are sort of interesting. Jodie Comer is usually pretty good in her stuff. I think she's sort of subdued here. David Harbour, on the other hand, I think like they gave him, I think it feels like he had a little more fun chewing on scenery. But yeah, it does that Resident Evil thing where you can like finish the game and then finish the game with the other character. And there's unlockables that you can only get by playing through multiple times. So it kind of gives you a reason to go through. And like, it all feels good enough in the moment that maybe you will want to play it a couple of times. But
how long was one playthrough?
I think you can probably finish it in like 8, 9, 10 hours, maybe even less than that. Like, and I was like really taking my time and like poking around and trying to find everything. And it's like, there's not like a, you know, I don't think it's like specifically doing anything amazing, but I think I was just in the mood for like a good third person action adventure survival horror type game. And it's, you know, it like, I feel like the variety in like the level design, like going in and around this house and like going to outdoor areas and like tunnels and sewers and stuff like that. Like there was enough in there that I was like, this is really well done. And I think the actual initial house area has like this really interesting, well-constructed feel to it in a way that like when you're unlocking doors and opening stuff, that feeling you got in the first Resident Evil game, right? Where you're like, oh, there's a hallway down there. I can't get to it. I opened it. Oh, it opened up a whole new wing of the house. And part of that looped me back to the original and there's a shortcut now. And like, so there's a lot of cool stuff like that happening, but
so I haven't dug too much into this, but I know that was it Darcetto Manor is, it's the setting of the first game. And if you go back and look at the first game, it shows its age. Like it is I think it's a couple years pre Resident Evil 2.
Yeah. I think,
Resident Evil comma 2, not part 2. But like,
yes,
it's interesting because so much of survival horror is rooted in adventure games, but we kind of forget that. And, you know, coming off of like, I get the feeling that the original Alone in the Dark, and again, I haven't I didn't play it back then because it was too scary, and I haven't played it recently because it's too old, and I'm a snob and an idiot. But no, like, it's less of a survival horror game and more of a scary adventure game.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, and
yeah,
that's coming into something that is trying to recreate that through the lens of expecting survival horror is a different experience. The whole survival aspect and the tension sometimes, you know, and it's also looking at the setting. It's what sort of a Southern Gothic revival with some like Lovecraftian mm-hmm. trappings. So much of like Lovecraftian horror is just sort of weird, you know, like it's not so much. Yeah, if you're watching the video, we've got some footage of the original horror, and it's like, it's so quaint. It looks like a LucasArts game. Like, it's very, you know, it's aged endearingly. And to look at that and be like, the title is scarier than the graphics, mm-hmm. which is hilarious. And, you know, how do you do that faithfully? Like, how do you give that a fresh coat of paint without making feel like you're, you know, doing some try hard, you know, edgelord stuff? And I don't know.
You're totally right. Yeah, you're completely nailing it. Like, that's actually my feelings to a T on this game. And it's like, I had to sort of recalibrate my approach to this game a little bit, because early on, I think I was like, okay, they're doing the Resident Evil 2, Resident Evil 3, Resident Evil 4 remake thing. And Resident Evil 4 remake is a game that I've, you know, played 100 times. Last year, the original game I played 1,000 times. And it's just, that's a quick, snappy game where you can also do pile drivers and backflips and stuff mm-hmm. like that. And you jump out of second story windows. And so, like, this is not that. This is way more rooted in the sort of like exploration, survival horror, point and click adventure, puzzles, like stuff like that. Like, you know, finding weird items and examining notes for clues. And that's, you're solving puzzles in this game a lot by looking through your notes. And I was taking pictures of my TV and like zooming in on images, and I had them next to me, and like I had a piece of paper that like I was writing down stuff on. And like, I think like that's a really cool, you know, that's a thing we've kind of moved away from a lot. And I'm guilty of helping that movement, because I love Resident Evil 4. And I think that's like, that pretty much changed the trajectory of what survival horror could be forever. And I think that even the first person Resident Evils had a bit of that, right? But they're still action adventure games. They're still first person shooters in many ways. Like, you know, you're doing a lot of like, it's a lot of like, you have a shotgun, you're running around a house, and you're shooting zombies type of things, right? And in this one, I think it's a little more sort of like slow paced and a little more methodic and a lot more kind of cerebral in terms of like, you're doing puzzles, you're collecting items, you're examining stuff, you're reading pamphlets and notes, and you're looking around for clues. And like, I dig that. I really do. Like, it's, you know, occasionally like I would bump my head against something and be like, oh my God, I'm completely stuck. I don't know what to do. And I would walk away for an hour or two and come back and be like, oh man, okay. So I had to just combine the information from three separate documents and then a picture in a room. And I would learn from that and solve the puzzle. And that reward would open up a door that would bring me to a whole new area. And like, man, I really dug that. But also, like, I completely understand why some of it could feel like a shortcoming to like the modern audience that is used to the way a game like this should look and feel, right? So, because I think that like, no matter what I say, you will still have to pull out a gun and shoot enemies. Yeah, and when that happens,
solving a puzzle and shooting something in the face are completely antithetical yes. things to do in a video game, but yes. survival horror games regularly fuse them together perfectly. So,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's the thing, that it's like the part that Resident Evil is not super interested in so much anymore. The puzzle stuff, this game is doing really well, and I dig it. The exploration of a small enclosed space, right? Like Resident Evil, that was its thing to begin with. And it's moved away from that a lot. You know, Resident Evil Village was not about a place. It was about a village, and you went to all these different directions. You know, Resident Evil 7, with that, you know, messed up bog house, like that's kind of the closest they'd come in a very long time. But Resident Evil is kicking this game's butt when it comes to, you know, shooting things and killing things, and that's a big part of this genre too. So I don't know.
You also don't make a game like this not expecting people to compare it to Resident Evil, because yes. of course they did. That's
yeah,
that's why this exists, because of the success of Capcom's, you know,
100%.
Yeah, I mean, this the next one up is going to be, of course, the Silent Hill 2 remake, which again, yeah. there are challenges that come with trying to recreate what people remember, and that's tricky.
Yeah. I don't know. I would maybe wait for like PS Plus for something like this, or like maybe get it on a discount or something, unless you're like a gigantic fan of this genre and you can't miss it. I really dug it. I don't know if, you know, that's something you want to buy full price on day one, mm-hmm. but you know, your call. If anything you just saw or heard makes you go, yeah, I want that, then go get it.
Not every game needs to be game of the year. Sometimes it's fun to just have like a little, you know, little weekend romp where you solve some puzzles and, you know, and hey, if you really suck at puzzles, maybe this is a 30-hour game. You never know. On that note, Brian, thanks for hanging out. Thanks for,
of course, this is great.
This is a good time. Thank you to everybody who listened at home. If this episode went up a couple hours late, I'm sorry about that. We were trying to hit the Dragon's Dogma embargo. We'll be back next week to hopefully talk about Rise of the Ronin, among other things, probably some weird stuff that came out of GDC. Who knows? Thanks for listening. And as always, beyond.
Beyond.
Have you ever watched a futuristic sci-fi movie and wondered, but wait, could any of this really happen? And will I live long enough to see it? That's what our show Hypothetical is about. I'm Carrie Bechet, and on this podcast, we ask what-if questions about the future. Like, what if we could read minds? What if the world's digital data was erased all at once? What would happen if the Yellowstone supervolcano erupted? Then we explore that question two ways, through speculative science fiction and through dialogue with brilliant scientists. The result is a genre-bending narrative that's interwoven with real facts provided by literal geniuses. And spoiler alert, a lot of the science fiction out there, it's not nearly as far-fetched as you might think. Come time travel with me into the future on Hypothetical. New episodes on Tuesdays, available on all your favorite podcast apps. Just search Hypothetical. That's HYPERTHETICAL.